Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with the esteemed cohort joining us live, I always like to do the altar call to invite you. If you aren't so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. We've already got Chris and Paul there athwart the quarterdeck. Be glad to greet you on board. And if you have any questions, comments, points of order during the course of the show, that is a great place to put it. We will be monitoring it during the course of the show, and if you have some questions that you would like for us to direct to our guest, if it sounds better than what we have, which is a pretty good chance, then we'll be more than happy to steal it and bring it on board before the end of the hour is done. And if you have to leave partway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, or if you haven't already and taking the step to go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, wherever you get your podcast, go ahead and do that. That way this episode and any episodes that you might have missed in the past will always be there and waiting for you for your commute or any time at your convenience. And let's go ahead and roll into today's show. And as you'll hear again in my opening question and probably once or twice more during the course of the show because I repeat myself, all you need to do is look at a map, a chart, preferably a globe, to see that if you're an American, you are a citizen of a maritime nation. And a strong Navy is only part of being a maritime power. And everyone is starting to appreciate that in the last year and a half or so as they looked at empty shelves, rising prices that are due to supply bottlenecks, and for those that live off of Los Angeles, Savannah, any of our major ports, or goes out to sea a little bit, and you see the little mini fleets of merchant ships waiting to come in there, we have overburdened ports and an infrastructure that has a variety of critical vulnerabilities that affects everybody, whether you've got to go get some food or you just want to get a new car or even a used car. Most Americans realize that weakness, and in maritime trade, it's not just what you want to buy. It's also whether you're employed, your neighbor's employed, or their ability to keep their employment. And part of the problems that we have is it hasn't reached a critical mass of national importance so that we have the right eyeballs and number of eyeballs that are engaged on the problem. And that is starting to change. And in order to take advantage of that opportunity, you need people who are thinking and talking in the right ears, hopefully the ears of people that have some levers of power and influence. And the more people that we can do that, the better. And today we have a returning guest who is doing just that. He's coming to the problem with some observations. And in a return visit to the program is our guest for the full hour, Lieutenant Commander Jimmy Drennan, U.S. Navy. And we're going to use this article that you can find linked in the show page, and we'll get it up in the chat room as well, titled Beyond Defense, America's Past and Future Interest at Sea, as a starting point for our conversation. Jimmy, his background is a surface warfare officer, and soon will be the outgoing president of the Center for International Maritime Security, a topic we may discuss later on in the show as well. And Jimmy here is a guest on his own, representing himself, and his opinions and points of view do not reflect those of the United States Navy or any organizations he may be affiliated with. Jimmy, welcome back to Midrats. We're great to have you on board.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about my article. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say I read it twice. You can see, and I encourage the readers, the listeners, who hopefully are readers, that if you haven't read it already, you can listen to the show and read the article at the same time, because we're going to touch on some of those. But when I went through it the second time, I kind of came away with a central thing, kind of like I said in my program. I want people to grab a globe and realize that we are the nation with, depending upon how you measure it, at least as of today, the greatest economy in the world with the world reserve currency. We have the foremost, most capable global navy, but we have almost the least most merchant fleet relative to our economic requirements of all of our allies and competitors. And you hit on a lot of the bold-faced items on there. So I just wanted to roll it to you that way. That's how I boil down the crux of the problem. Is that pretty close?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, economy is really dependent on the maritime domain, and that goes all the way to the beginning, even before we even had a navy. I mean, you know, look at Alexander Hamilton and starting the Revenue Marine to enforce tariffs. He was trying to stop smuggling because we were in danger of losing a ton of revenue, you know, which would have been, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in today's dollars. And so he commissioned 10 cutters and started up the Revenue Marine. And, you know, from there, that eventually became what we have today with the Coast Guard. You have the U.S. Navy, of course, as well, which grew over time from 6 frigates all the way up to 6,000 something ships at its peak, and now down into around, I think it's 290, I think, at the current count. And so, you know, our founding fathers understood how important the sea was as the lifeblood of our economy. And, you know, that I think is something that we may have lost a little bit in the American people today, have what I would call sea blindness. You know, certainly the world's most powerful economy, maybe not forever. If you look at China and their growth, some estimates that they're set to outpace our GDP as early as 2028. And so as I was looking at that, I thought maybe we need to kind of rethink the way that we view our relationship with the maritime domain. You know, what are our maritime interests? And then of course, in the context of China, there's this, of course, great power competition is the buzzword for the past several years. And so one of the questions that I was considering was, you know, how many ships would it really take to effectively, you know, warships is really what I was initially considering to effectively compete with China. And of course, there's, the famous analysis done by Ottawa, which kind of defines the number, which has fluctuated over time. I think 355 was a common number at one point. I think it's higher now. But in any case, I was just looking into that. My kind of hypothesis was that there is no amount of warships that will effectively compete with China, because they're not competing in the same way militarily. In other words, they're using the gray zone strategy in the maritime, another buzzword. But, you know, they're kind of below the threshold of armed conflict. They're using other arms of their government and their populace to gain influence over regional partners, to strengthen their economy, And so if we build 500 warships, I'm not convinced that that would effectively stop them from taking more and more influence in the maritime domain, which, you know, it's not a zero-sum game, but it does, that does have an influence on our ability to generate that economic prosperity, which is, you know, which is what a lot of people believe is kind of the point of the Navy. In fact, I wrote about that, you know, Mahan, you know, his theories kind of centered on the fact that his theories are that a Navy serves a primarily economic purpose. So if you buy into that, then how many warships do you need? The answer may be you can never have enough because you're not effectively competing. And, you know, I dug into that, and I actually found, you know, the report done by the Naval Studies Board on the 1,000-ship Navy. And, of course, that was the CNO's I'm drawing a blank. I think it was Mullen. In his vision for global maritime partnerships. So not that the U.S. Navy would have 1,000 ships, but that there would be a global maritime partnership consisting of 1,000 ships, you know, our allies, to pursue mutual goals in the maritime. And it was very interesting to read that report because it talked about the U.S. government suffering from a quagmire of bureaucratic and political hurdles, and there was no really one agency that effectively could speak for the president and the nation's maritime concerns. They made several recommendations, like setting up an agency that would, you know, similar to the Federal Aviation Administration, but it would have been, you know, they didn't go far enough in my mind. They kind of said, well, that would be underneath the Department of Defense or Department of Transportation, or even just like standalone. And my thought, and another thing in that article, in that report, is that it doesn't even mention China. It was written in 2007, and it was very much focused on the post 9/11 kind of global war on terrorism. Let's prevent WMDs from, you know, crossing into our borders. No mention of China and the threat that they would become. And so I think they missed an opportunity. And I think now we could look at it in a new light and say maybe there's a need for a cabinet-level department to harness, exploit, and protect our maritime interests, which go beyond defense. That's hence the title of the article. I'm not convinced that the U.S. Navy really belongs in the Department of Defense. Certainly, it's a military. It's a branch of the armed forces. So is the United States Coast Guard. And so I think we should look at a cabinet-level maritime department, which would take the Coast Guard, several other maritime agencies, and the U.S. Navy, focus on kind of that Mahanian point of view of let's strengthen our economic interests, our diplomatic power, international influence, however you want to look at it, use the Navy in that way, not with force, but showing the flag and forward presence and things that the Navy is really good at. And then, of course, if you cross into conflict, then you can employ the Navy that way. And you could, just like we do with the Coast Guard, transfer it from DHS to DOD in times of conflict. We could do the same thing for the Navy. So, anyway, that is sort of the basis for the article and why I titled it Beyond Defense and proposing this maritime department.
One of the advantages the Chinese have is they don't really have their complicated government is not as complicated as our complicated government, in the sense that one guy can say I want this and they make it happen. From what I gather from your article, there are four different agencies, including the Navy department within the Defense Department, maybe there are five different agencies involved in trying to get some kind of maritime strategy going, and I think you pointed out there are like four of them. Can you kind of talk about how we got into this situation from your research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I identified four national maritime strategies, and I'm not convinced I found all of them. The Tri-Service National Maritime Strategy is the one that most people would think of. That's released by the U.S. Navy, Coast Guard, and the Marines. And it is, as you might expect, it's focused on those services, and it does address economic aspects, but it doesn't branch into the Maritime Administration, Department of Transportation. It talks about maritime security, but we've got another strategy called the National Strategy for Maritime Security, which is whole of government, not released by it's released by the White House, and then that's released in 2004. It hasn't been updated. It focuses exclusively on global war on terrorism. Doesn't mention China. In fact, when it talks about conflict between nations and great powers, it only mentions that because the threat that could create conditions for WMD to cross into our borders. So, and attacks on the homeland. So it's in dire need of being updated because it just speaks to a different world than the one we're living in today. And then, of course, on the economic side, there's the Department of Transportation's National Maritime Strategy, which, it's just a tangled mess of bureaucracy because you've got this Committee on the Maritime Transportation System, and that's the kind of the network of facilities and waterways that basically enable maritime transportation for our economy. And they've got a five-year national strategy for the MTS. It was last published in 2017. DOT also has a national maritime strategy. They're not the same, which is interesting to me. So you've got one department with two national maritime strategies, and then you've got other strategies I don't know if they're subordinate or not, like the national strategy to map the EEZ, the exclusive economic zone, and I think there may even be more, but they're all really just aspects of a holistic national maritime strategy. I think there really needs to be some really good interagency coordination, and I hate to even say that word because I'm not convinced that interagency coordination truly exists unless you're talking about the National Security Council or if a JIATF is established, a Joint Interagency Task Force. Just in my research, it seems like that is a lot of hand waving when you say interagency coordination. So that's why one of the reasons I recommended, a maritime department to oversee that and develop a strategy. Let's take all of these national maritime strategies that we have. They're all good for different reasons. Oh, another one I forgot was this national strategy for establishing maritime domain awareness. And let's bring them all together and let's address our national interests from not just the economic perspective or a national security perspective or defense. Let's take it all and let's really figure out what we need to do to advance our security and prosperity because they go hand in hand, especially in the maritime. And it's not just our shores, it's the globe because our supply lines reach across the world. So, and we have different laws, depending on where you are. So, we need to be able to coordinate whether it's domestic or with other governments overseas. So that's why you need to have almost a diplomatic aspect. There needs to be that. There would certainly be an overlap with state, but you know, Department of State is not the lead for our maritime economy overseas. So you can't just rely on our diplomats to do that for us. So that's where I think the many national strategies are just piling up on each other, it seems like.
I think if the for the listeners, if they haven't already pulled up your article, go ahead and do it, because I thought one of the more powerful is probably the wrong word, but it was a great illustration of the problem, because it's hard to verbalize that problem until you see it. And you created a graph there that shows how incredibly disaggregated this problem is. And in the article itself, you flesh out, you know, this is at Department of Commerce, this is the Department of Transportation, this is over at DOD, this is Department of Homeland Security. And it just, I think, brought to the point that as our governmental bureaucracy grew in the last half century, 70 years, that it just became incredibly disaggregated. And to the point that it makes sense now why we have this dysfunction in our larger economy and our maritime security arena. It would almost be as if you were going to build a house, but instead of having a home builder or a contractor do it, you decided that you were going to call an electrician, you're going to call a plumber, you're going to call a concrete guy, you're going to call a framer, and there wouldn't be any single person that's going to make them all work together. And your house would be a complete, utter dog's breakfast when it's all said and done, which is kind of one way to describe where we are. Is that what you saw as you dug into it, is just the inability to, even on a good day, on topics that are in subject areas that aren't connected with each other, to get one cabinet level department to another to work together, that's part of the dysfunction, is the fact that you have these integral parts of the larger requirement that are just spread out all over the place inside different fiefdoms.
Yeah, for sure. I think at some point along the way, I think we kind of lost sight on what the ocean really means to America, and we've tended to, and this is probably, you know, my perspective, because I'm in the Navy and I grew up, you know, in a Navy family. So I have seen that we've tended to over associate our maritime interests with national defense and with the supporting war effort. We rely, the U.S. Navy became the world's most powerful Navy, and to the point that it really had no opponent after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so I think Americans just kind of assumed that the U.S. Navy would safeguard our maritime interests. And that's just not the case. It can't do it alone, no matter how big and powerful the U.S. Navy is. So these other organizations kind of meandered on their own, maybe with a little oversight, just no strategy really, or I guess multiple strategies. You know, you look at the Merchant Marine, today's Merchant Marine is really rooted in the U.S. Shipping Board, 1916. At the time there was about 10% of U.S. trade, which was carried in U.S. flagships. And so it was stood up to address that problem and to support the war effort. And after supporting the war effort in 1933, it was essentially disbanded. They moved the shipping board under Department of Commerce, and eventually it became the U.S. Maritime Commission. That commission disbanded in 1950, and then that's how you got the Maritime Administration, MARAD, and the Federal Maritime Board, which became the Federal Maritime Commission in 1961. And so you can see how there's just this meandering of bureaucracy without a real focus on what the whole point was. And that's just one part of it. I kind of broke it down into two halves when I talk about our maritime heritage. There's the Merchant Marine, and then there's the Coast Guard. I kind of already talked about how the Coast Guard had evolved over time. But it goes on and on, because then you've got the Coast Guard going into the newly created Department of Homeland Security. Well, that also had the Customs and Border Protection, which maintained a subdivision called Air and Marine Operations, which were tasked with securing the nation's maritime borders. Well, isn't that kind of what the Coast Guard does? And I know that there's a subtle difference in mission there, but, it's, again, another example of bureaucratic, I guess, fragmentation that, and I guess bureaucracies don't tend to be very efficient anyway, but our federal government is, our system of government is extremely powerful. We know that. Our economy is also very powerful, our capitalist economy. We can harness that. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is bureaucracy is not all bad. We can harness it if we maybe just coalesce our efforts a little bit into, and that's why I suggest the Maritime Department, and not just a Maritime Administration, which is a sub-department of the Department of Transportation, critical to national security, as I mentioned, our over-reliance on foreign carriers, and really our fleet of the Merchant Marine is just a shadow of what it once was, and that's a national security issue. So I know there's a lot of coordination between MARAD and the Navy and DOD, but again, if we were going to really harness the maritime and recognize how important it is to our future, to our prosperity, then you'd think you would want to put all that together and develop a cohesive strategy. Because, like it or not, that's what China is doing. It's apparent to me that they've recognized the importance of the ocean to them, and they are kind of rewriting the rules. And that's something that they're doing blatantly. And so there's this stark contrast between what they're doing, just very directed, and what we've been doing, just kind of meandering in terms of maritime strategy.
Yeah, China's kind of interesting because it's a 72-year-old country with a many thousand year history. And so they're playing a lot of catch up, which I kind of admire in one way, but their insistence that the rules that have been developed over the time that they were growing up don't apply to them, because I never have quite figured out the reasons, because they were unfairly treated sometime in the past, I guess. And that poses a problem. I mean, you point out that, among other things, and this is another reason to kind of talk about rethinking these issues, is that they have this incredible fishing fleet, both the close in and distant waters, and they have a lot of other assets, their maritime militia stuff, which we don't even think about in this country unless we want to call the Coast Guard auxiliary some kind of maritime militia. But, the focus on that kind of stuff is really important. And your view is, I'm gathering, is that it would be better under one agency with one head or a group of heads that could really think this problem out and direct our national assets in the right direction. On the other hand, and maybe we did that during World War II. I don't know if you looked at any of the history of how we got all those ships made and set up, both the Navy ships and the Merchant Marine ships that were built. Did you pay any attention to that? Are you familiar with what they did?
The U.S. Maritime Service was created by the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, so that was part of my research. I don't know if I included this in the article. It was, I think I mentioned earlier, I have a much longer version that I had to trim down, but, there were over 3,000 Liberty and Victory class cargo ships operating across two theaters in World War II that were administered by the Maritime Service, and that's not the U.S. Navy. That's separate. Just after World War II ended, the Maritime Service kind of suffered a bureaucratic demise. I mean, it still exists today, but the Secretary of Transportation kind of retains a symbolic cadre of USMS officers. The Maritime Administrator is one of them. Ann Phillips, the President just nominated her, retired Admiral Ann Phillips, to be the next MARAD Administrator. So she would also be the Commandant of the U.S. Maritime Service. And then the presidents of the six state maritime academies, and then of course graduates of the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. That's it. That's the Maritime Service. As I said, it's sort of symbolic today, but that was critical to Allied victory in World War II with the amount of cargo ships that they were operating across two theaters. And it's an interesting comparison to what China does today with their maritime militia. It's a paramilitary force. They're usually not armed vessels, but they're reporting up a chain of command. So it's a lot of surveillance, presence, just kind of establishing themselves in other nations' territorial waters. In the South China Sea, which they view as their water, and they just sort of establish that presence, and they report on activity at sea, and they have a very clear command and control structure. So not that different. And then, of course, you talked about the distant water fishing fleet, which is separate, but I think of it sort of like a cousin to the maritime militia. They're not really under any C2 of the PLA, but there's an economic aspect to their to the distant water fishing fleet, and it's incredibly important to them. I mean, China's, I think it's by 2030 they're projected to have somewhere between 6 to 18 million ton shortage of fish. So they are going out into the ocean's waters, into other nations' EEZs sometimes to harvest those fisheries. And that hurts other nations' economies. And I really do think it's only a matter of time if the trends are unchecked that they would start fishing in our EEZ. Ours is the largest in the world, very difficult to police, even to maintain awareness. They talked about, maritime domain awareness, even knowing what's going on in our EEZ, let alone police. So I do think that is a necessary element of competition that we need to look at.
One thing you mentioned before that came up pretty early in the article is, we were talking earlier about things that you just assume but then are forgotten. And everybody likes to talk about the great maritime theorists. Ironically, a lot of them are American. The Chinese have studied. And I felt kind of guilty because I didn't realize Mahan had made this point. I just read right over it and it didn't stick in my brain. But with what you're talking about right there about the very real things that China is doing on the high seas around the world, in many ways strip mining marine resources in nations' waters that can't defend it. As Mahan makes the point that navies primarily serve an economic purpose. You can see that not just in the infrastructure and the jobs at home, but it's one thing for the Argentines in, when was it, 2009 or maybe 2011, where they sank a Chinese fishing vessel who was in their waters. Nations think twice when they're going to push against China when she has a fleet 20% larger than the Americans. Kind of pull the thread a little bit on that Mahan view of the importance of navies as primarily as an economic, if not engine, at least catalyst for a nation.
Yeah, so I think that China certainly has studied Mahan, and you can see that in the way that they're behaving at sea. And you mentioned Argentina. There's this really interesting graphic in the article. It's a snapshot of using AIS data, and it's a snapshot of a marine traffic website, and it shows all these Chinese fishing vessels lined up just a mile outside of the Argentine EEZ. And, you know, that's just incredible to me. And, of course, there's other studies that have shown that they will go dark and that they will go inside to fish inside the EEZs, but they'll also comply nominally with international law. So we talk about the gray zone, but they really stay in the white zone very well also, and they just generate this incredible economic power through the sea. And of course, as you mentioned, the nations will think twice pushing back when they've got the world's most powerful navy. Of course, they have the world's largest navy right now. Up to debate whether it's the world's most powerful or the best or whatever metric you want to use. I think they could be building this fleet not to go toe-to-toe with the U.S. Navy or some other navy in war at sea, but to kind of underwrite their economic strategy to serve as a credible deterrent for their distant water fishing fleet, for their maritime militia in establishing control over the South China Sea, which they believe all of it is theirs. There's the nine dash line, which from the very beginning of the PRC, they've said this is ours. Even though they signed UNCLOS, which established a 12 nautical mile territorial waters, and ironically we did not, we still haven't, but they did. I think that probably just they viewed it as politically expedient at the time, and that was I think 96 when they did, and but now they kind of just throw it aside and disregard it, and in fact they've even passed a couple of laws recently that allow their Coast Guard to enforce all of the South China Sea as theirs, and theoretically even with lethal force, which of course I think would really be pushing it if they were to start doing that. But that's the way that the trend is going, and is if they have this credible deterrent of a navy, and then they establish this presence, then they may not need to use any force, and they can just start to reap the benefits of their economic strategy and use their large navy as a deterrent force. There's an argument to be made that the whole reason they established this their base in Djibouti is to ensure that they have access to the Bab el-Mandeb Strait to get into the Red Sea for their merchants, and to make sure that they, you know, that's a critical lifeline of the economy for them. Another critical route is up in the Arctic. They are working with Russia to utilize the Northern Sea Route, which is a competitor as ice is melting in the Arctic. There's a couple of routes that are opening up, which would shorten the distance between Europe and China. And one of those is the Northern Sea Route, and that is controlled. That kind of goes into Russia's territorial waters. And then there's the Northwest Passage, which should go into Canadian waters. And so they're really putting a lot of effort into that, and they're putting naval power behind it to ensure that they have that route available to them. So I do think you could look at Mahan and see how they are pursuing a maritime strategy and using their Navy not to defeat the Americans at sea in World War III, but to intimidate, maybe is a good word, other nations into allowing them economic access. Does that kind of answer your question?
You know, I'm reading your article and I'm having a good time fantasizing about the expression on the Secretary of Defense's face when somebody says, you know, we need a maritime department, and so we're going to take the Navy away from you. And, you know, history, we did at one point not have a Department of Defense. We had Secretary of War and Secretary of the Navy and the Navy Department and the, I guess, Department of War. I don't know what it was. But I just imagine in these modern times how this would be quite a shock to the Secretary of Defense to suddenly have a competing force. And I'm gathering that you view this as a way to get out from underneath this sharing of funds that goes on where we make sure everybody gets their third, even if there's some doubt that some of the entities are getting their third or fourth or whatever the space command, whatever they are, is going to get Space Force. Is that part of this, a way around the stovepiping of funds that we've seen?
Yeah, definitely. That's a sort of a separate debate that's going on right now that we haven't touched on, is the how much money does the Navy need in order to effectively accomplish its mission and defend the United States at sea. And this whole dividing the budget into equal parts, which is kind of just, I don't think it's mandated, but it's something that's happened over time, and it probably will continue to happen. There's a lot of lobbying going on. So this is, as I was doing my research on a potential maritime department, that was something I keyed in on, is that it would be a way for us to properly resource our maritime interests. Money's got to come from somewhere. So just because you move the Navy into a different department doesn't mean it's going to necessarily get more money, but you could look at some efficiencies when you put the Navy, Merchant Marine, Coast Guard, and some other NOAA, for example, some other agencies together. You kind of can pool your resources and you can pursue maritime interests with a single pot of money, basically. I do think that the DOD would not like it very much. Secretary Austin probably would not like it, or any secretary for that matter. But that's okay. I mean, it's part of the concept and the proposal is just to spur a debate. Hey, why wouldn't this be a good idea? You know, tell me where I'm wrong. I'm sure that there are things I missed, but I would love, you know, for example, I mentioned Ann Phillips. You know, let's make her Secretary Phillips, make Secretary of the Navy Del Toro work for her, and then make her a peer of Secretary Austin. And let's move all these agencies under her purview, and let's see if we can get somewhere with it. So, you know, just throwing that out there to spur a debate, because, and I think I wrote in the article, you know, I don't know how we're ever going to properly resource the Navy under DOD when it's mission goes beyond defense. If its job is not just one aspect of national defense in the maritime, but it's, you know, safeguarding our economic interests at sea as well, well, that's not DOD's job. So why would it be resourced properly? Why would DOD give the Navy money to do things that are not within DOD's mandate? So that's where I think we're missing something there if we have it in the way. Yeah.
Well, Jimmy, you'll appreciate this. I know our friend Claude Berrabet, he listens to the show, so I'm going to make a Star Trek reference just for Claude. But kind of like the Borg will find interesting life forms and will assimilate it into their own. One of my because I know my co-host shares some, if not all, of my feelings on the topic. Kind of a recurring topic during the years we've been doing MIDRATs is the fact that we had the National Security Act in 1947. And if you do the math, the next big change was Goldwater Nichols in 86. It's time, now that the Soviet Union has been gone for a couple of years and we've just got through doing what we've been doing so far this century, that in the third century of the 21st century, the third decade of the 21st century, that we need to restructure our national security apparatus to better meet our needs. And part of that is not just getting rid of Goldwater Nichols, looking again at the concept as we executed it of joint, the COCOMs. And your idea here but really falls in that niche really well. I know there are some people in Congress who are interested in this in both the House and the Senate. They are just waiting for the critical mass to get there and for enough ideas to be put in place to give them something to work with, that they want to go in this direction. It's just that the fruit's not ripe for picking, so to speak. But fleshing this out and getting this in front of the right ears and maybe incorporate it into other things if you're going, Jimmy, I can see where, as a standalone battle, this might be too hard, but if we're going to eventually get a critical mass, which I hope we do, to relook at how we structure our national security apparatus, that the issues that you brought up here make sense, because you can't fix a bureaucracy by just creating more bureaucracy. However, if you consolidate along logical and functional areas, and you can find connections to other, if not competing, at least in the same ecosystem, drives and desires for efficiencies and clarity, that I think this can fold into that pretty well. Because I've had people ask me, okay, you want to get rid of Goldwater Nichols, what do you do with the Navy besides make the Navy Department again? And now I have additional tools from this article that I can use as a discussion, because you mentioned NOAA, and I'm sure that there are other areas that didn't make the final cut for publication. That where the vice president lives right now is up at the Naval Observatory. It used to be the natural home for not just celestial but also weather, because of its importance to the Navy. There are a lot of things that really impact the maritime environment, but they're all scattered all over the place. So if we found ourselves in the next, three or four palm cycles, so to speak, that there was a serious effort on the political side to redo that National Security Act, kind of looking at how you looked at it here, do you see parallel actions perhaps with the Air Force, Space Force, Army, that if we're going to re-baseline everything, that using the ideas you did in the maritime component, maybe the Army and the Air Force can find some ways to better align their interested parties in the government?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, you bring up space, and there's some maybe redundancies or fragmentation that have developed over time that we could definitely address with the Air Force and their purview over space operations. I mean, I'm still not sure I understand the difference between Space Command and Space Force, but I'm sure somebody could explain it to me. But you could look at everybody. Everybody has some interest there, and I know that there's some efficiencies that could be gained. I'm right there with you. The Goldwater Nichols needs to be revisited. I mean, if we're using Cold War era legislation to govern the way we do business today, then we're doing something wrong. It's not that we need to redefine ourselves every time some new conflict comes along, but it's about time to revisit it. It's been a while since we've been going toe to toe with the Soviets that don't even exist anymore. And so the world is different. I mean, you know, I get frustrated when I see strategies and policies that are rooted in GWAT, the global war on terrorism, and don't even mention China when China is clearly the competitor, the pacing threat. You know, they are the ones that you're going to have to keep an eye on and compete with, and not just militarily but economically. So we're pursuing strategies that we have written strategies that are not aligned with our current actions, and that needs to be addressed. And Goldwater Nichols is another example of that. You know, we've got the joint staff, the chairman's staff, the joint staff is not in the operational chain of command for the military, but de facto, as is today, that's how it works. And that's not in writing. It's just how it's evolved over time. And so one of the things that I think has been discussed is whether or not you want to make them, you know, you want to rewrite the National Security Act so that the Joint Staff has an operational role. I'm not going to weigh in there pro or con, just to note that we're currently acting in a way or operating in a way that's not consistent with how it's supposed to be done according to the legislation. So we could definitely look at that. And I think Goldwater Nichols and I mentioned earlier the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, that, you know, the United States has never signed that. We kind of abide by it as customary international law, but we've refused to sign it, and yet we espouse a strategy in the Pacific of international rules-based order and a free and open Indo-Pacific. I think if we're going to kind of maintain that as a strategy, then we are talking out of both sides of our mouth, and we need to be more consistent. And I think part of that is to sign on cloths and accept I understand the economic risk that goes along with that. I think some of that is obsolete. But I think we are undermining our own strategy by refusing to sign on cloths. So that's another example of some legislation that needs to be revisited. So this maritime department as an idea, I think hopefully will spur some debate. It's not the end all be all, but it's hopefully something that will cause people to go, you know what, maybe we could do things a little better, because I'm convinced that we can and we need to.
Yeah, UNCLOS is an interesting object lesson in international law, but before there was UNCLOS, there were still rules that the United States complies with, a lot of which are contained in UNCLOS. So it's not like we're totally at sea on this. We're the objections we had were to certain, as you said, certain potential economic situations. But overall, a lot of the stuff in UNCLOS is not a surprise to internationalists from before the date of the signing of or that convention was created. Just an aside, one of those curious things. I'm trying to figure out we've got, you're looking at U.S. shipping, which means we would want to increase our merchant fleet, which is privately owned, but sometimes funded by the federal government. We need to update our National Defense Reserve fleet. I think Sal Mercogliano has addressed that pretty regularly. We have issues with the number of auxiliary ships that we would need if we were to go to war and the kind of crews that need to man those. I mean, I'm looking at all this stuff and I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be a pretty – if it takes all these bundles of stuff you've talked about from all these other agencies – this can be a pretty large organization, and I'm going, well, is this just bureaucrat swapping one large bureaucracy for several small bureaucracies, but small bureaucracies which don't always work together? I mean, is that my dread would be that we'd end up with something akin to the Department of Education instead of what I think your goal, which is a pretty meaningful goal.
Yeah, I do think that's a valid counter argument to, you know, you don't want to create bureaucracy for its own sake, but I hope that the if it were to happen, it would be to streamline what we already have to organize ourselves a little better, not to grow the federal government really at all, because all these things are happening. But what you have is sea blindness. You've got all these things happening with no real cohesion or focus on what our maritime interests are, and particularly among the American people, which are represented by Congress, and they're not investing in it. So the Navy is only one example of that. As you mentioned, the National Defense Reserve Fleet, you know, the Merchant Marine, just completely underfunded. I mean, our reliance on foreign shipping today is reminiscent of what it was in 1916, I think even more so, when Congress created the shipping board, which, you know, was to address that and to support the war effort. So I could see that happening again. Of course, we already have all that federal structure in place. So hopefully we wouldn't create a new organization, but we would bring them together and address the problems that we have with the underfunding of the Navy, the Merchant Marine. Our ports are another big example. I mean, look at what's happening today with the supply chain crisis. We certainly have some infrastructure investment to make, you know, and we don't necessarily need for the federal government to dole out the money directly. Maybe we could create incentives for private industry to invest themselves. But, you know, there's something I think that we could do. And I wouldn't want to suggest that we become another China with a sort of a state-owned enterprise kind of economy. Certainly don't want to suggest that. I think we need to harness the power of our capitalist economy. And, you know, there's ways that we can do that. I don't. That's what I didn't want to do in the article, is prescribe certain method to get this done, but only that if we reorganize ourselves at the federal level, then we might be able to focus and develop a single strategy with some real concrete steps toward properly resourcing these organizations and our infrastructure to really, you know, harness that economic power that we have and what we need so badly. I mean, like I said, it goes all the way back to the first days of our republic and the creation of the Revenue Marine. You know, they understood then how important the sea was, and it's only more important today. It's not just on our coastlines, but it's all over the world. So we need it more than ever.
I think part of that economic argument is where we continue to fall short. You know, I love the fact that you very subtly put us all on report, because you said, you know, back in, you know, 1916, when they created the board, the shipping board, yep, that 10% was the issue. And here we go, we find ourselves modern day, and we're down to 2%. So we haven't achieved much at all. And I like this little quote you had at the end, that if current trends persist, the U.S. will increasingly rely on Chinese infrastructure for its seaborne trade and transport, reminiscent of the conditions that led to the establishment of the U.S. Shipping Board in the first place. And one of the few things that's holding shipping together is things like the Salomar Cagliano is going to kill me. Help me out, brother. The act that the Cato Institute is always yelling against. The Jones Act. There we go.
The Jones Act, yeah.
The Jones Act. And a lot of the arguments that people seem to continue to make are based on these very stale, stovepipe, to use that term, economic argument about, well, you know, we can actually have Brussels sprouts at 0.02 cents less per pound, and if we have foreign carriers, and we'll be able to buy shoes for 1 cent less. We don't seem to have a good argument on the other side, economics. Besides Sal Marcagliano and a few other guys in the merchant industry. Have you seen anybody, as we kind of wrap up the hour, I think we as navalists, whether we're naval officers, whether we're people who study the maritime industry, you know, we get it. But part of it is trying to explain to people in the American public and in Congress the economic impact and importance of that. And in your research in this article and maybe some feedback you've gotten it, you know, are there some people that we haven't talked about or you and I both don't know, do you think have really made a good argument that the listeners might want to look towards or keep an eye open for that could help flesh out the argument? Or do we need to go through?
I think we do. I mean, you made a great point about the Jones Act. I didn't weigh in on it because, to be quite honest, I'm not sure. I need to do more research on it to see where I really fall on the issue. But it, as you pointed out, and I think Sal's point of view is that it's not just an economic issue. There's a national security aspect to the Jones Act that, you know, you need to have a certain reserve force capable of surging. And you need them to have United States flags. So we can't rely on foreign shipping too much, even though the world has certainly changed. The global economy has changed very different from what it was 100 years ago. But you can't just rely on particularly Chinese infrastructure, and they are dominating the maritime space. So the more and more that they own and operate ships, terminals, ports, you know, we rely on that, and they can, at some point, they could take that away from us. You know, if they have influence over the local governments or they have influence over the shipping companies, then, as I mentioned earlier, it's not necessarily a zero-sum game, but if they have influence more than we do, then we stand to lose some key access points and shipping power that we depend on, we might not have in times of conflict. So you've really got to think about that national security aspect. So in terms of people, Sal is one of the leading thinkers on that, John Conrad of G-Captain. I have to mention Representative Elaine Luria. She released a new maritime strategy on our website, on the CINSEC website that you can find. It has got some really great ideas in it and just really pushing us forward in terms of thinking about the challenge that China poses and how we can, you know, better pursue maritime interests. And then there's as you mentioned, other people, the thought came to mind. There's a recent article on CINSEC that you can find on the front page, and it's titled "Beyond Competition: Why the U.S. Must Cooperate with China and Russia for Maritime Stability." And the authors are Jan Stockburger and Christian Buger, and they take a different point of view than I do. But it's really interesting. It's very well written and well researched. So I would definitely check that out. And then of course there's a variety of thinkers that publish on CINSEC that you can get a different international perspective, non-naval perspectives. Because as I continue to hit on, you know, maritime security and the maritime domain is more than just the Navy, and particularly more than just the U.S. Navy. So our maritime interests are well beyond naval interests.
Well, Jimmy, we've abused you for a little over an hour now, and I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Before I let you go, though, I need to find out what you've got going on, if we're going to see anything else from you soon, and if so, what, and anything else you got going on you'd like to tell our listeners about.
Thanks again, guys. It's been great to chat with you and talk about the article. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. I am my time as the president of CINSEC is coming to an end, so at the end of the year, I'll turn over with a new team. We have nominations actually open right now for the elected officer positions, and we'll hold elections in the next month. And then I will step back and kind of take a passive role in CINSEC. And in the meantime, we do have a couple of interesting collaborations that are that are in the works. One is with the German Maritime Academy, DMI, and they've got a project called MarTrends 2030 Plus that we're going to support with the SimSec website in our community. And that's really interesting. Look it up. It's a kind of a kind of like our Project Trident on our website. It's looking at the future of maritime security and maritime trends, looking at into 2030 and beyond. And second, we've got some collaboration in the works with the newly announced Center for Maritime Strategy, as a by the Navy League, and so we hope to have some announcements there soon. But they've got a really interesting initiative under retired Admiral Fogo, and I think that's another really positive development, looking at how we can, you know, harness our maritime power and secure our maritime interests under you know, a sort of a comprehensive maritime strategy. So interested to see what happens there.
Well, that's a lot bubbling.
Yeah, there's always something.
That's good, though. Well, it's been a great hour. It's been nice catching up with you, Jimmy. And we hope you have a great holiday season and look forward to the next time to talk to you.
All right. Thanks, guys. Have a great night. And, yeah, I look forward to it.
Glad to have you. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time. Hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.